Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on Fubar Radio.
Hello, you're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Zoe Grunewald.
And me, Ali Milani.
Coming up on today's show, Nigel Farage stepped down as the MP for Clacton-on-Sea, triggering a by-election which none of the other major parties are contesting. We'll discuss the latest. And then, world leaders have been in Turkey this week for the NATO summit. We're going to unpack the key takeaways.
As always, you can find us at Politics Uncensored UK on social media, but first, it's the Week Unwrapped.
What a week it's been in politics. We're going to start with the biggest story of the week, which is Nigel Farage announcing he was going to step down as MP for Clacton. Here is what he said in a speech on Tuesday afternoon.
I've thought about it hard and I've decided today I will resign as a Member of Parliament for Clacton-on-Sea, thereby forcing a by-election. No, I've decided that the people of Clacton should be the judges of my actions. This will be a people versus the establishment by-election. It's a chance to stick two fingers up to the entire establishment.
The announcement comes amid growing scrutiny of Farage's finances. Earlier this week, The Times reported he had failed to declare benefits, including staff and security, provided by his longtime ally, George Cottrell. Farage is also already under investigation by the Parliament Standards Commissioner of an alleged failure to register a £5 million gift from a Thailand-based British cryptocurrency billionaire. Since Farage's announcement, Labour, the Conservatives, the Liberal Democrats, the Green Party and Restore Britain have all ruled out contesting in the Clacton by-election. Ali, did you watch Farage's speech?
I did. Did you watch it?
I did. I thought it was an extraordinary speech and not in a good way.
Okay.
I thought he came across kind of unhinged, actually. Mm-hmm. He was incredibly thin-skinned. He was sort of ranting and raving about how he was being attacked by the media. He was being attacked by politicians. He did this kind of poor me shtick of, you know, I got very, very poor fighting for Brexit. And, you know, these people who've given me all this money really care about me. And what's wrong with being rich anyway? He sort of went from talking about that to then this random statement about how men can't wear watches in London anymore. He compared donor rules in Britain to like living in communist Russia. And then 15 minutes in, he announced that he was going to resign, which really was the headline.
Yeah.
You know, it was just, I think that the key thing for me is, if Farage's appeal is built on being a man that you want to sit and have a pint with, I certainly do not want to sit and have a pint with the man who's ranting and raving for 15 minutes about how everyone hates him. I mean, he went from man you want to have a drink with to pub bore.
Yeah, I'll say a couple of things about it. First of all, the speech was really, really weird insofar as a speechwriter, right, it was the first job I ever did in politics was speechwriting. It's still the thing I think is one of my best skills in politics and I enjoy doing the most. I think it was a really strangely constructed speech insofar as clearly the headline of that speech is I'm resigning. Mm. And you typically put that at the beginning. He's very much buried the lead in there.
Yeah.
So far as when I was watching it, there was all these rumors about whether he was going to resign. And about 5 minutes in, I went, well, he's not going to resign clearly because we would have gotten there by now. This is going to be a ranting, raving sort of at the establishment. And so when I was quite surprised by the time he got to the resignation bit that he was going to resign. There's that element. There's the element, other element where I suspect he riffed quite a lot of it.
I thought that
because there
well.
Were sections that he was kind of umming and ahhing between points in a way that you don't know if you're reading a teleprompter. And the thing that was most striking about this speech for me, about Farage, was Farage has been, for all his anti-establishment talk, Farage has been a mainstream politician longer than I have been alive. And I'm not that young, right? He has been in politics since, I think, 1994, in mainstream politics since 1994. And he's had to contend with a fair bit of controversy and allegations of impropriety, of racism, of all sorts of stuff, right? But the last week, he has looked flustered in a way that I have never seen him before, certainly. Mm. If you'd seen the video of him at Heathrow Airport, I think it was, with Sky News, he was viscerally angry. And then I thought, even in the speech, which was a very contained speech, there were no journalists in the room, no opportunity to ask questions, it was clearly him in camera, even in that control setting, I thought he looked flustered.
Yeah.
And I thought he looked angry and he didn't look in complete control. And he's someone who has dealt with allegations and all sorts of scandals before. So what's different about this one? And I think what's different about this one is he knows he's fucked.
Yeah.
And I think he's trying to control. Obviously, the reason he's decided to resign is one thing. But Nigel Farage's reaction to things is a very good indication of what he thinks is going on. And I think the level of sort of anger and frustration and being outside of his usual sort of energy and rhythm tells you that I think he thinks he's fucked it.
Yeah, I agree. I think this is his last stab at trying to seize back control of the narrative. But I don't think he's really thought it through. I mean, we'll be talking about more on this later in the show with Ellie Hodges, who is a political journalist and commentator. And at that point, we'll talk about kind of what comes next and what might have led him to this point. But I agree with you. The whole thing stunk, actually, of desperation. Before we move on to the next story, I just want to quickly talk about Count Binface.
Legend.
So, as we know, all of Farage's main rivals have ruled out standing in Clacton. So Labour, the Tories, Lib Dems, Green, Restore Britain have all said they're not going to do it, essentially calling it a stunt, saying, you know, they're not going to get drawn in to Farage's political tantrum. There are actually lots of really funny statements from the leader, various leaders. You know, did you see Rachel Reeves saying because she had to give permission, basically, for him to no longer be for him to stand down. And she said, look, if he wants to spend his summer arguing with a bin, I'm not going to stop him. And that brings us on to Count Binface, who is going to be the main challenger, it looks like, to Nigel Farage. What do you make of that? Do you think Count Binface could become the new MP for Clacton-on-Sea?
Yeah, well, first, can I ask you, do you think it's the right decision of all the parties not to stand?
I do, actually. I think it's clever. I think it's completely the right decision.
Doesn't give him an opportunity to... first of all, I'm fairly sure, I was just looking it up while you were talking, I'm fairly sure I'm the only person Count Binface has ever endorsed in an election.
Count Binface endorsed you?
Yeah, in 2019. Either that or Lord Buckethead, because there's two of them.
Yeah,
but
there
I'm pretty sure it was Binface.
Mm. Binface follows me on Substack and reposted one of my articles.
We're both mates.
what I find particularly funny about Binface is... what I think is going to be particularly funny about this is... Farage is going to say nobody's standing candidate because they're all running scared. Whatever. You know, Farage is probably going to win Clacton again. That's sewn up. That is what it is. The point is that now he's going to have to literally spend the summer arguing with a bin, like Rachel Reeves has said, a man who is a trained comedian who is going to constantly draw to light how self-indulgent this is. And Farage can't play party politics with him. He can't accuse him of being part of the establishment. And what is going to be burned into the electorate's mind forever is an image of Nigel Farage standing on stage at a by-election he called to save his own ego, to prove the point that he should be able to accept donations from people and not declare them, next to a man wearing a bin on his head.
Yeah, but by the way, that shot is going to be amazing, because it's not going to be just him. It's going to be, you know, all the crazies.
Lawrence Fox.
All the crazies that show up. Okay, it's going to be like an array of like different people with different costumes.
It's going to be great. Well, we're going to talk more about that after the break. Let's just move on to another couple of quick stories, because it's been quite a big week in politics, as it always seems to be. Obviously, there's been the FIFA World Cup happening, and politics has become unexpectedly intertwined, or perhaps not so unexpectedly, because, of course, Donald Trump exists in this universe. One of the USA's star players had his one-match suspension following a red card overturned by FIFA after intervention from Donald Trump. Here's what Trump had to say about the decision at a press conference.
Yes, I asked for a review by FIFA. I spoke to a man who's highly respected. I think it would have had a big stain. And I related just that feel. I didn't tell him what to do. I can't tell him what to do. But and I don't believe he made the decision. I think it was a committee that made the decision. And they made the right decision because, number one, it wasn't a foul. And you want to see a game with your best players.
We're so lucky to live in a world where Donald Trump is not only the greatest leader of our time, but also such an expert on football. Right?
Yeah, yeah. There was a moment, not in that interview, but a previous interview, where he says, "I think I know this stuff well." That man hasn't kicked a ball in his life.
No. What do you make of this, Ali? You're more of a football fan.
I could talk about this all show.
All right.
By the way,
well, we've got about 3 minutes.
So. I think FIFA have completely destroyed their reputation with this World Cup. Not least, like, let's set aside the fact that they gave Donald Trump a peace award and Infantino has been simping for Donald Trump for what seems like 2 years now, and I don't quite understand why. Let's put aside the fact that at this World Cup, we've had coaches, we've had members of staff, and even mainstream referees refused visas into the World Cup, which I don't think has ever happened before, which meant that, you know, players and teams and staff members haven't been able to go. The treatment of Iran has been shameful. The fact that the Iranian football team have only been able to take the bare bones of their coaches and staff to the States anyway, but they then had to move their base away from, I think it was Arizona, to Tijuana, and then were only allowed to fly in on match day, which has obviously significantly affected their performance. You put all of that controversy to one side, and then you get the USA's main, like, one of their best players, their striker, gets sent off for what I think is a harsh red, but a red, right? And Donald Trump rings up the president of FIFA, and then lo and behold, a few days later, that red card is, the punishment for that red card, the ban, is suspended for a year. And I think nothing tells the story of the level of reputational risk that FIFA is at better than Sepp Blatter, probably the most, like, controversial football figure ever, who had to sort of resign in disgrace, tweeting his own sort of displeasure at the way that, that FIFA has dealt with this. It's never been done before. What I think is particularly outrageous about this, and Trump said it in his speech about whether it was a red card or not, the red card hasn't been rescinded. The punishment has been suspended for a year. And I just think it's then, like, there's nothing sacred that Donald Trump won't completely fuck up in this world. Football, like, the
world, really thinks of himself as God. Like, he can just touch everything.
Yeah.
Right?
And, but the problem is Infantino has let him.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think it has brought the reputation of the entire tournament under question. Infantino is an atrocious president of FIFA anyway. The way he has dealt with Trump's beginning, which has been just to basically pander to his narcissism from the beginning, is embarrassing. But now for that to reach the on-field decisions, if that makes sense, I think as so I think, funnily enough, this World Cup has been pretty amazing in terms of the football and the tournament, but Infantino, Trump, and everything off-field has stained the reputation of FIFA quite significantly.
Just to slightly bring it back to a positive note, do you think we're going to get through on Saturday? Is it coming home?
So after the Croatia game, I told pretty much everyone I know, I think England's going to win this World Cup. Because I thought I saw...
Do you think we're going to win?
Yeah, I thought after that Croatia game, I think I saw all the necessary bits that usually takes for a team to win.
Right, if we're down to the final, it's actually next Saturday, isn't it?
Yeah.
And that's my hen do.
Oh, is it?
So
you're going to have to watch. I mean, the final... Oh, no, it won't be too late because it's not a single game.
Oh, Sunday. I thought it was Saturday.
It's the 19th of July, so it's Sunday.
Sunday. Oh, okay. Yeah, well, that's good. No clash. All right, that's fine. England,
but that's, by the way, we can record. Do you think we're gonna? I think we're gonna win it.
Okay. Sure. Why not? I don't know what I'm talking about. Yeah, we're gonna win it. I want to talk about this, Ali, because this is really important to me.
Yes.
Just like football's really important to you. More in Common have done a poll of voting intention by taste in pop music. Really interesting. Really interesting findings here. So, Reform support is strongest amongst Take That fans. I don't find that particularly surprising. And Dua Lipa. Do you know who Dua Lipa is?
I do know who Dua Lipa is.
The Tories do best among One Direction fans.
Yeah.
Greens are dominating among Chapel Roan fans. That's not surprising
to me.
That
surprises me. The One Direction one surprises me.
Taylor Swift fans come closest to being a three-way Labour ref contai. Blue Labour, I think that is, isn't it? Taylor Swift is Blue Labour. Harry Styles fan take us to two-party Labour and con politics. Ed Sheeran was the most elected and Reform narrowly lead, followed by Paul McCartney with a narrow Tory lead. What do you make of all that?
So I don't know who half these people are, but but here's who I do know. So Billie Eilish is quite green and Labour heavy. That makes sense.
That
to
makes
me,
sense.
Right? Like younger audiences.
Yeah. Same with Bad Bunny.
Bad Bunny, obviously. I'm surprised Bad Bunny isn't more green than Labour, to be honest. Sabrina Carpenter as well. The Lily Allen one and Little Mix being so Reform. How does that make sense? Isn't that like a girl band?
Yeah, it is. I think because it's sort of like very kind of easy pop music that it maybe
It's got a broader audience.
Broader audience, yeah.
Maybe.
But Lily Allen is
interesting. Take that being reform and conservative, like, obviously. That makes sense.
Ed Sheeran being reform makes sense to me as well.
Taylor Swift has quite a lot of reform voters in there.
Well, you know.
They're heartbroken, isn't it? That's what it is.
Yeah.
They've had their heart broken and they've either gone to Taylor Swift or Nigel Farage.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, all right.
Maybe she can drop a £5 million endorsement.
Yeah. Don't give her any ideas.
Don't give Nigel any ideas.
Okay, look, well, that is that. I think that's quite that's quite fun. There's really not a lot of analysis we can do there. It's just fun to like.
Oh, before we move on quickly, yeah. I know which one of these would you put yourself in if I had to give you one of these pop, like one of these artists? Like,
well, obviously, if you had to only be a Taylor Swift fan, but that doesn't ring true for me.
No, no, not in terms of how they're voting, but.
Oh, Taylor Swift.
Taylor Swift is the one that you most identify with.
Mm. What about you?
I'm trying to think of the PR. I'll go with Bad Bunny.
Yeah, that's nice. I love Bad Bunny, by the way. So
great wrestler.
Yeah. Right, okay, that is it for The Week Unwrapped. Coming up, we're going to be speaking to Ellie Hodges, political journalist and commentator, to get her take on Farage's decision to step down as an MP. Stay tuned.
Politics Uncensored with Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald on Fubar Radio. Follow us at Politics Uncensored UK for more from the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Zoe Grunewald.
And me, Ali Milani.
So we're going to go back to the top political story of the week, which of course is Nigel Farage's resignation as MP for Clacton. And we're going to have joining us shortly will be Ellie Hodges, who is a political journalist and commentator, to talk about why she thinks Farage might have made this decision. But Ali, if we just wind back for a moment, because I want to talk about something that I think is really key here, which is that essentially Nigel Farage is essentially trying to stand down and force a by-election. And he said in his own words, in the clip we heard before the break, that he wants the people of Clacton to make a decision about his behaviour with regards to these donations. But I don't understand how the people of Clacton can make an informed verdict about his conduct if they don't have all the information available. Mm-hmm. So the key question for me is Nigel Farage prepared to give the people of Clacton all the information he would have had to have given the Standards Commissioner about these donations?
Yeah, and well, the answer to that
will be no.
Will be no. But the question I would be asking if I'm a voter of Clacton, and I have enough self-awareness to know I'm probably not the what you would call the standard voter in Clacton. Wouldn't be me or my politics. The question I'd be asking is, why not just wait till the investigation concludes?
Yeah.
Right. If you're confident that you've done nothing wrong, the Standards Committee, which is a bipartisan, it's not a partisan committee, right? It's not a political committee, should find that you've done nothing wrong. Even if your position is that it's a highly, it's been politicized and that they're using the Standards Committee to get him out, then you can make that argument to people once the investigation is concluded. Because what is entirely possible happens here is he wins a by-election, because right now the investigation is suspended until after that by-election. The investigation will then recommence after he's presumably wins the by-election. And then if it finds him guilty, it could force him into another by-election.
Yeah, and what a waste of money. What an extraordinary waste of money.
I am really curious. There's one thing that I don't, I haven't seen enough evidence on, and I'm not sure journalists have dug into enough, is why does Nigel Farage need so much money? It seems to be a consistent thing. If we're not talking about these crazy gifts and donations that he's got, we're talking about his cameo appearances and why he's doing that as a member of parliament and leader of a political party. If we're not talking about the cameo stuff, we're talking about the gold, the what was it? The
gold bullion.
The good bullion stuff that he does. If we're not talking about that, I think you're about to say it, we're talking about his GB News. Like, why does this brother need so much money? And how expensive is his lifestyle?
I think this is why he's gone very hard in his speech about why he's the most attacked. He called himself the most attacked politician of modern times, which is an extraordinary thing to say when Joe Cox and David Amos were murdered.
Yeah.
But calling himself that, I think he's trying to make the point that he is in desperate need of staff, security, all these resources that he can't otherwise afford.
His argument was, I could buy a Ferrari with this if I wanted to. And that might be true of the £5 million, but it's not going to be true of the gold or the cameos or the GB New presenting or all that kind of stuff.
Another thing I found really interesting about Nigel Farage's speech was that he mentioned Christopher Harborne And he threw his weight behind Christopher Harborne and thanked him, said he was tremendously grateful for the support Christopher Harborne has given him. So the crypto billionaire has given him £5 million. But he didn't mention George Cottrell.
Right, who's the other person
who is the other person who the Sunday Times came out and said he had been giving money to and had not declared it. I thought that was interesting.
We should also say Robert Jenrick is now under investigation as well. That's broken over the last couple of days that the Metropolitan Police are investigating reports that some of his donations originated from outside the UK.
Very interesting. I mean, I think this is a stunt that is going to backfire in his face, because he might want to move the conversation on from these donors, but actually this is what this election is going to be fought on, right? His right to accept donations and not have to declare them if he doesn't want to.
Yeah, it's also the Standards Committee aren't just going to, you know, the Standards Committee aren't driven by public narrative. They're driven by whether you've done something right or wrong. So presumably, even if he wins this by-election, even if he's successful in changing the public narrative on it, then that investigation will just recommence.
Absolutely. Right, I'm going to bring in Ellie Hodges now. Ellie Hodges is a political journalist and commentator. Ellie, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Ellie, I want to ask you, what do you think Nigel Farage is trying to prove by standing down and triggering a by-election?
I think that a lot of people know by now that Nigel Farage isn't the kind of politician to just back down the minute that things get a bit difficult. And I think that his way of dealing with all of the scandal around the donations and George Cottrell was just by saying, actually, you know what, I'm going to double down. I'm going to give the people of Clacton a chance to decide my future. And it's a way of him, I think it's a way of him saying, okay, I'm just going to go at all of this head on and not hide behind anything. And I think that it was the right thing to do, because you had politicians as well, opposition parties, calling for a by-election. And then when Nigel Farage actually called it, saying, oh, this is just a stunt. So I think that he's in a bit of a position at the moment where no matter what he does, he's going to get criticised and he's going to get told that it's the wrong decision.
Ellie, do you think that the people of Clacton can actually make an informed verdict, though, about Nigel Farage's conduct with regard to this donation? Is he prepared to give them all the information and documentation about these donations that he would have given to a Standards Committee? And if not, how can they make an informed view about whether or not he's done something wrong?
Well, I mean, pretty much all of the information is actually in the media anyway, and that's.
But he won't say what he used the money for. He also won't explain why he didn't declare it. He also won't really describe these relationships. I mean, don't you think the public should know that he's accepting money from people and why he's accepting them and why he didn't feel the need to declare it?
Well, I mean, they do know that he has accepted this money, though, because it's been all over the media for the past couple months. I mean, the £5 million donation, the media haven't stopped going on about it. Every single time he goes on to the BBC, Sky News, whatever it is, they're always asking him questions about it. And in his resignation speech, you know, he did talk about the £5 million. He spoke about how, whether you believe it or not, he spoke about how he needed it for security. He spoke about all of these different reasons why he has that. And I think he did make a good point. And I heard you talking just before I came on about, you know, he gets all these different sources of income from GB News or from cameos, whatever it is. What actually is the problem with that? I don't understand what the problem is of someone making money.
Well, the problem, Ellie, thanks for joining us. Ali Milani here. The problem is he gets paid circa £90,000 to be a member of parliament. Yet he'll get a £5 million gift from one billionaire. He'll make thousands of pounds from Cameo. He'll make thousands of pounds from GB News. He'll make potentially hundreds of thousands of pounds from gold. The problem is voters will ask, who does he really work for? Is it the gold companies? Is it Cameo? Is it this billionaire? Or is it for me? When I'm being drastically outspent, if I'm the voter, I'm being drastically outspent in his income.
I mean, exactly. And voters are going to have the chance to make a decision on that in this by-election.
My point is, I don't see how they can make an informed decision on this if Farage won't be forthcoming about exactly what this donation came with. He says, of course, it was a personal donation. But how are voters supposed to believe that when he's also using his platform as the head of the Reform Party to lobby the Bank of England governor about Bitcoin, to talk about making the UK a kind of a revolution in cryptocurrency? I mean, do you really think the public are supposed to buy that there's no relation between the two?
I mean, the public can have whatever decision that they want to come to, they can come to, and they can form their own opinions on Nigel Farage. And this by-election, we will see what the people of Clacton actually think about Nigel Farage. And if they think about him, actually, you've been my MP for 2 years, I feel like you've let me down, then they won't vote for him. Simple as. And I think that this is actually a bit of a referendum, actually, on Nigel Farage and on his future and on the future of the Reform Party.
Ellie, can I ask, why not just wait till the investigation from the Standards Committee is done?
I think, well, the investigation actually won't be finished until around September. That's a hell of a lot of time in politics. And I think that the way that Nigel Farage works is that he wants to just face his head on and say, you know what, I've had enough of everything. I've had enough of the smears. I've had enough of Sky News going and harassing my daughter. I've had enough of the death threats every single day. I've had enough of all of this. I've had enough of every single time he goes on to the media being asked about this £5 million donation.
That's not going to stop, because if he wins the spy election, which he's likely to do, that investigation will reconvene and will come to a conclusion anyway. So that's going to continue anyway.
We'll see what the conclusion is. But
so that can't be a reason as to why he's called this now, because that's going to reconvene anyway.
Well, I think that is the reason that he has called it now, is because you've had this £5 million donation thing that, quite frankly, isn't going away anytime soon. You had the George Cottrell stuff, and he's saying, I've had enough of this. Let's call a by-election. Let's see what the people of Clacton will decide. And I think
understand, why not wait until the Standards Committee have concluded on their investigation, which, if he's done nothing wrong, the Standards Committee is not a political organ, you know, it's apolitical, will reach that conclusion that he's done nothing wrong, and then he can go to the people. Whereas, as it stands right now, it's entirely possible that he wins a by-election, the Standards Committee conclude that there needs to be another by-election, and then we have a second one by October. So why not just wait until it's finished?
Well, as I said a couple of minutes ago, I think the way that Farage works is that he wants things to get over and done with as quickly as possible. And when this investigation, they're not going to come to the conclusion until around September time. That is a long time in politics. And all of this will continue. And I think that we saw in his speech when he was saying he's going to resign as an MP, that he's quite frankly just completely had enough. I think that Sky News harassing his daughter was, I think, just the tipping point. And I think that you could tell that he was angry. As he said, I've never been angry before in my life at how I've been being treated by the establishment. And I think that his way of dealing with that is saying, OK, by election now, the people of Clacton can decide my future. My constituents can say how they feel about me. And I don't understand why everyone's has kicking up such a fuss about that, where there was actual politicians and commentators calling for Nigel Farage to have a by-election over this.
Who was calling for a by-election?
He's confirmed. I mean, there was lots of commentators saying that because of the
commentators,
population.
Was anyone serious? Who was? Which politicians were calling?
I can't remember the exact names, but I wouldn't just come out with that for no reason. People were saying that because of the £5 million donation, he should be calling a by-election.
Okay,
and now
Ellie,
he's called a by-election, and people are saying,
Ellie,
that that's the right thing to
I
do.
I want to ask you about Count Binface, because Nigel Farage clearly thought he was going to have all the different political parties standing candidates, and they've all basically refused, calling this a political stunt. It looks like Nigel Farage's main challenger is going to be Count Binface. Don't you think this makes the whole people versus the establishment thing look like a bit of a joke? I mean, Binface is not part of the establishment.
I mean, it is quite funny, and I was saying this the other day, I can't remember what show I was on, I was saying, if you had to explain UK politics to someone that's not from here right now, how on earth would you even go about it? You have someone that might be the future Prime Minister of this country running against a literal bin. I mean, it's hard to even give any worthy analysis on it, because it's just so ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, do you think that actually, though, this isn't going to be great for Farage, because he's trying to make a serious point about how he's been harangued by the media and politicians, and he wants to put it to the people of Clacton, but they're not really getting a proper choice. I mean, it's going to be between Nigel Farage and, as you say, a man wearing a bin on his head. I mean, isn't it kind of making a joke of the people of Clacton? I mean, deciding to throw your toys out the pram and call a by-election to prove.
Well, I don't think
that's
him throwing his toys out the pram, though. I think it's the other parties that are refusing to
but
stand
as Ali, But as Ali said, and I don't want to labour this point, but he could have just waited until the Standards investigation had concluded, and then he wouldn't have had to force a by-election. It costs hundreds of thousands of pounds, and now it's
and
going to be
offered,
him standing
on
the scale.
Hold on,
Ellie, you know that Reform can't pay in this
but
country.
But they did offer
but
to pay for it.
It is illegal. Political parties cannot buy elections in this country. We do not
but
live.
But they have offered to pay for it, right?
Okay, but they know... But okay, you can offer to do something even if you know it's against the rules. They have done that purely. I mean, you must admit that's
it's like
start.
When I go for dinner with my dad, I can offer to pay, but I know it's not going to happen, and he knows it's not going to happen. Can I ask you quickly, Ellie, about this people versus the establishment thing?
Yeah.
Nigel Farage has been in mainstream politics longer than I have been alive. He was a city banker before then. He's friends with billionaires and presidents. bit of a joke. It's a bit of a joke, isn't it, that he calls himself not the establishment?
I don't think it's a joke at all. I think you see the way that the
establishment... So, ex-City banker, millionaire...
Dulwich School.
And has been in mainstream politics longer than I have been alive, is anti-establishment.
I mean, I don't know how any of those things mean that he's establishment.
Okay,
because
he's rich and powerful.
That means he's establishment.
He's rich, he's powerful, he goes to very powerful schooling, has been involved in politics for over 30 years. How is that not... If establishment doesn't equal wealth and power, what does it equal?
Well, I think when I think of what being part of the establishment means, I think being part of the main political parties, I think...
he's one of the main political parties.
I think that saying that Nigel Farage's establishment is a ridiculous thing to say, where throughout his whole entire political career, he's basically gone against what everything the establishment says.
Well, Brexit was pretty establishment. It was backed by Boris Johnson.
I would not say that was pretty establishment at all.
Well, it was backed by Boris Johnson as well as mainstream other political parties. He's now, like you said, leader of a mainstream political party. So we'll tick that one. He's a millionaire. We'll tick that one.
Was it about 2 years ago?
He's very rich. We'll tick off the fact that he's regularly in the company of crypto billionaires and presidents. How do you define establishment if it isn't just the establishment being people who I politically disagree with?
Well, I think that we're seeing the way that the establishment works since Nigel Farage has announced this by-election. We're seeing all political parties from across the political spectrum coming together to basically be anti-Nigel Farage. That's how I would say the establishment works. We've seen Richard Tice has actually reported the National Crime Agency for leaking his bank statements and his conversations with his bank. That's what I would say.
He hasn't provided evidence for that, has he?
And that's absolutely outrageous. And I think that we're seeing these dirty tactics that are coming from the political establishment. And to say that Nigel Farage, the political establishment, when he has spent his whole entire political career being against the establishment, is ridiculous.
All right, Ellie, thank you so much for joining us. That was good fun. We were joined by Ellie Hodges, political journalist and commentator. Ellie, we hope to get you back soon. Thank you.
Definitely. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. Okay, after the break, we are going to be talking all about the NATO summit. And I'm sure there'll be more to say on the Farage story coming up in the next show. Sorry, I'm just taking note after all of that. But yes, after the break, we're going to be talking about NATO. So please stay tuned.
It's Ali Milani and Zoe Grunewald with Politics Uncensored. FUBAR Radio.
Welcome back. You're still listening to Politics Uncensored with me, Zoe Grunewald.
And me, Ali Milani.
Oh, are you sure? Okay. This week, we saw dozens of world leaders gather in Turkey for this year's NATO summit. The meeting comes at a time of growing geopolitical uncertainty, with the war in Ukraine showing no sign of ending and tensions continuing to rise in the Middle East. There is also growing pressure from Donald Trump for NATO allies to shoulder more of the burden on defence spending. And joining us now to unpack the key moments from the summit is Katerina Lusanova, a Ukrainian-based journalist based in Washington, D.C., and a media advisor with the American nonprofit Raisin for Ukraine. Katerina, thank you for joining us.
Hello, Zoe. Nice to be with you guys.
Thank you. Let's start by just talking about Ukraine. How central is continued support for Ukraine to NATO's wider security strategy?
To NATO, I think it's one of the most important things, because Russia is too close, if we're talking about those members who are located in Europe or in that region. Turkey itself had a moment when they were obligated to shut down Russian jets which crossed their airspace, if you remember that happened years ago. Mm-hmm. But the point is, the threat of Russia is not only a threat to Ukraine, and it's something that Russia is claiming publicly. This is something that they're stating publicly. And before attacking Ukraine, they released a public document which they called Security Guarantees for Russia, in which they said that they're claiming their interest on all post-USSR countries, which Poland is included. And so we don't need to go far to talk about how much big of a threat Russia is. And we also have very visual pictures of what they actually are doing. We're living in this life when all those crimes that they're doing is very hard to hide. And their statements are very public about the threat. Mm. So for NATO, obviously, it's very critical. And also another thing, it is very important for NATO countries to be aligned with Ukraine, because Ukraine happened to be at some point in that moment when Ukraine didn't have enough support and it needed to develop its own technologies. And we see how those technologies are right now, very developed, very new, and a lot of countries are actually needed and want it and want to be a part of it. So this is, I think, the reasons why for NATO, Ukraine is very important.
Katerina, can I ask, the relationship between NATO states and Donald Trump has been up and down and frayed at certain points, particularly the famous sort of White House scene between President Zelensky and President Trump, but also our own Prime Minister in the UK has had frayed relationships, as have others. Based on this latest summit, where do you think we are? Have some of those relationships improved? Where do we sit at this moment in time between Donald Trump and the rest of the NATO allies?
I mean, this summit looks more positive. It looks more aligned. And statements of Trump, if not talking about Greenland, but most of them were more positive and more aligned with its allies and regarding Ukraine specifically about the possibility of manufacturing Patriot systems in Ukraine domestically. This is something that they at least publicly stated that gonna happen, which will be helpful for Europe, for United States itself, for Ukraine as well. So far it looks not bad, but the movement in general and what Trump is demanding to increase its protection by NATO members, European countries, the movement itself, it's more divided. We just got used to it, which means Europe need to develop its own protection systems, its own manufacturing of weaponry. Europe already in this situation that European members of NATO need to think about themselves and need to do themselves more, and they cannot rely on the United States. And whatever we saw in this summit, it was more positive. But in the same time, we're still in the situation where European members of NATO need to do more by themselves.
Mm. Can you tell us a little bit about the significance of Turkey hosting this year? Obviously, Erdogan and Trump have a close, complex relationship, but Erdogan has been under quite a lot of scrutiny for his own rule in Turkey, his kind of quashing of human rights. And there have been questions over Turkey's role and, I guess, symbolic role as well in NATO going forward. Just tell us a little bit about the significance of Turkey and Ankara as the host nation.
I think it's played a lot of symbolical role that it's hosted NATO. It's almost a sign that NATO itself and European and Western countries given a signal to the Turkey that we want Turkey to be a part of democratic society. We want it to be this part, not only NATO, but the European Union for that point, if you know that there was a possibility for Turkey to be a part of it as well. But there is a problem. Turkey has not, if I can call it, it's not very stable in the way you can perceive it because of those reasons that you just mentioned, because of democratic questions, because its leader had been in power for a long time, and there are issues of suppressing freedom of speech or many other things. At the same time, Turkey is trying to play this role on both sides, while there is a lot of criticism related to what is happening internally. Turkey is trying to play externally more with the European allies, more with the Western allies, particularly in case of Ukraine. Turkey stood up as a very helpful mediator and supporter. In the very beginning, Turkey provided their drones and their weaponry for Ukraine. So you can say that Turkey doesn't want to lose the thing that it already has. And Europe, Western countries want Turkey to be a part of it. But for this, Turkey definitely need to change internally a lot of things. If we're talking about democracy, if we're talking about the freedom of speech and other things. And it's a separate case. I think we are at the point when the world has so many challenges that internal case of Turkey kind of became something that we can talk about like secondary a little bit later after we can save the world itself.
Katerina, let's talk a little bit about the war in Ukraine. We're many years in now. And as happens with things like this, as the years go by, certainly on our screens here in the UK, it takes less and less of a priority in terms of media stories and coverage. That's obviously not the case in Ukraine itself. Where are we at with the war? If you wanted to give our audiences an update in terms of where we sit currently.
It's a very interesting question, actually. It's a very good question because first part of your question, that the media coverage obviously always being reduced with any topic because the news circle, the news agenda is always changing and changing so rapidly. And also the life that we're living in with social media, with all this very fast consumed information, it's very hard to have one topic always on a point, always following the one topic. But I will tell you my own experience as a journalist who always covering specifically Ukraine and through the context of United States and Western world, I would tell that a lot of people actually are searching in the Western world, searching for this information, and they feel lack of this information. Mm-hmm. There is a reason because every single country has its own problems and the coverage changing. But I would tell you that what I experienced from my personal work, that when the coverage of what is going on in Ukraine is reduced, there are a lot of people coming to my personal social media or something like that, and they actually searching for that. And I'm talking to you about many countries in the Western world, because in the end of the day, what is happening right now looks very much familiar to the World War III. And when the World War II was happening, people were following it each day. And I think there is a big part of a society in each country who actually wants to follow it more. Mm. If coming back to what to follow, what is going on right now, Ukraine is definitely looking like it has an upper hand right now. And the and it's all because of the technology that it developed. We're talking about the drone. And also, it's not only drones, which it became such a complex and difficult thing, which means when I'm talking about drones, I'm not talking only about the sky. There are also marine drones, the one who pushed out Russian Navy from Black Sea, which is amazing, which is unbelievable. And just during the NATO summit, actually, Zelensky said that those Navy drones are right now not only they are not just operating in the sea, they also can launch from the sea, doing attacks from the sea. So it's like very complex thing. There is also unmanned ground vehicles. And this thing is developing very much. And if you remember, there is a first in world unit, their name is NC-13. And the first time in history last year, they've been able to obtain Russian positions without using any infantry, only unmanned ground vehicles and the drones involved. So like basically the robotic systems right now taking upper hand in the war in Ukraine. Ukrainians using it very much because partially also because Ukraine is smaller than Russia. They don't have that much people to involve and they actually taking care of every life it's possible. So they're trying to use this technology more than people on the ground. And this is what we see right now. And this is developing very rapidly. And Ukraine seem to have an upper hand here. And this is a question, how long Ukraine going to have it? Because first of all, just imagine the very fact that Russia doesn't have safe place anymore. There is no, literally, virtually no oil refinery that hasn't been a major oil refinery in Russia that hadn't been hit by Ukrainian retaliation strikes. And you can imagine Russia, the virtually biggest country in the world. One of the big thing that Ukraine did, it's made its size of Russia to play against it, to show that they're not capable to protect their positions anywhere.
Yeah. I just want to ask you, because we've got to let you go, unfortunately, in a second, but I wanted to just finish off by asking you, you know, after this summit, do you think NATO is looking stronger and more united in the face of these global threats? I mean, you've touched on, obviously, Russia. We haven't spoken much about the Middle East, but of course, that's also a big worry spillover from there. Do you think that should we feel more confident in NATO going forward?
I think NATO has a very long way to go right now. This is something to aim for. NATO need to be more aligned. And I think the answer would lie in when NATO countries and this alliance that Ukraine is creating right now will be able to create its own ballistic system, anti-air defense ballistic systems, which doesn't exist, which literally NATO countries doesn't have any other protection except the one that United States providing them with, which means they're completely depending on one country, which right now doesn't seem to be very reliable. So I think this is a big test. after which we will see if NATO is more united or not. Mm.
Thank you, Katarina. That's all we have time for. Thank you for joining us today. That was Katarina Lisanova, who is a Ukrainian journalist in Washington, D.C. and a media advisor with the American nonprofit Raisin for Ukraine. Ali, we've got a few minutes left of our show. I want to talk both about this and just touch on the interview we did before. But let's just start with this. Really interesting there, and heartening to hear that Ukraine is really holding firm against Russia, mm-hmm. and you know, using that kind of drone warfare in a way that seems to be giving them the upper hand.
Yeah, and it seems like at least in the last 3 months that some of the reports coming out of Ukraine have shifted in. I don't think you can ever say who's winning a war, but that they're doing significantly better, particularly with the drone warfare. Did you see Zelensky's little quip with Donald Trump when he asked him whether he's willing to go to Moscow and meet with Putin in Moscow? And he came up with a really funny line that I thought was, well, Moscow's really unsafe because of the amount of Ukrainian drones that are overhead right now, which I thought was quite a funny little quip. But also gives you a sense of where they think they're sort of power lies. And that's where, I mean, we had this, you know, last week we interviewed the journalist who focuses on defense spending. And he mentioned how a lot of the future in terms of defense investment is drones. Drones seem to be the way to go. The other thing, obviously, that's clouding all of this and has coincided, ironically, with the NATO summit is the peace deal with Iran seemingly going up in literal flames. So we'll see how that uncovers over the next episode.
Yeah, I'm sure.
What do you think of the reform interview?
It didn't change my mind on anything. Shock. I have to say.
Yeah.
I think, you know, you're absolutely right to point out that Farage is anything but anti-establishment, and I
just can't see what's the definition of establishment if it's not him.
Well,
in my mind, establishment equals wealth and power. Yeah. Right? He goes to a private school.
He's been in politics all his
longer than I've been alive
for years and years and years.
And I'm not that young.
You know, and the idea that Brexit was some anti-establishment movement, I think now we know. It wasn't. Wasn't.
I think the vote was anti-establishment.
Okay,
but the campaign wasn't.
The people who funded it.
Yeah.
You know, all of that stuff. We now know that it really wasn't anti-establishment.
Okay. The way I would say to this to people listening, yeah, forget the name and the individual. I'm going to describe a politician to you, and you put him in the establishment camp or the non-establishment camp. Privately school educated. Went to work in the city, made loads of money, has been involved in mainstream politics for over 30 years, has been a member of the European Parliament and a member of Parliament, receives millions of pounds of donations from billionaires, pals around with presidents and billionaires, has his own media show, right, on mainstream media. This person
sits in the House of Commons.
Are they establishment or are they anti-establishment?
It depends whether you agree with what they're saying or not, Ali.
Let's do this. I don't know if we're going to clip this up. Let's put it to a vote to our wonderful, the people, right? I'm not going to Clacton, to the people of Clacton. I'm going to the people of our social media channels. This person that I've described to you, could be anyone, are they establishment or anti-establishment?
We'll let our lovely listeners decide.
I think this is what producers call like social content.
We got 30 seconds left. I know we touched on the football earlier. So you think it's coming home? You think we're going to win against Norway? Can I just ask, if we win against Norway, are we straight in the final? Or no, do we have to play again?
No, we've got to play Argentina.
Oh, we've got to play Argentina.
Well,
okay.
Argentina versus Switzerland.
Okay.
And Argentina have been shit, though.
Okay.
And let me end on this, justice for Egypt, because I think Egypt were really hard done by in that game against Argentina.
Okay.
But, no, so we're the quarters, so we beat Norway, and then we've got to beat probably Argentina, and then to win it, we've got to beat probably France.
Okay, awesome, good. Well, good luck to the boys. Bring it home on Sunday. Okay, that is it from Politics Uncensored today. Join us next Thursday at 5 p.m. where we unwrap the week's political talking points.
You can stay up to date by following at Politics Uncensored UK on social media, where you can find me at Ali Milani.
And you can find me at Zoe Grunewald.
If you've missed any of today's show, you can listen back and catch up at foobarradio.com or via the Foobar Radio app.
Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week for another episode of Politics Uncensored. Foobar Radio.